content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. We're reading this week from the December 7th, 2018 issue of the Week magazine. The cover drawing shows a very large gate, looks like a heavy metal gate, and on the far side of it are a lot of Latino folks of all ages, kids, adults, kind of looking through the gate. On the near side looks to be somebody in the Army carrying, and heavy equipment and assault rifle and looking through the gate. The title this week is No Asylum, Why the Migrant Caravan's Arrival Caused Chaos at the Border. And that is our first main story. We will start there. Chaos on the U.S.-Mexico border. What happened? Border Patrol agents used tear gas to repel about 500 migrants who stormed a border crossing near San Diego this week as President Trump moved to restrict their ability to claim asylum in the U.S. The chaos ensued after 7,400 members of a caravan that departed Central America on October 19th began massing in Tijuana near the San Ysidro port of entry to the U.S. With only about 60 asylum claims being processed daily and food scarce in their tent city on the Mexican side, a group of frustrated migrants marched on the border barriers to demand entry. When they were blocked by Mexican federal police, scuffling broke out, and some migrants scaled the wall while others pried holes in fences and sprinted through the traffic. Some hurled rocks and bottles at border agents. Four of them were struck, although none was seriously injured. Border agents fired volleys of tear gas over the border to try to drive the migrants back, with women and children caught in the choking fumes. "We ran, but when you run, the gas asphyxiates you more," said Anna Zuniga, a 23-year-old from Honduras, who was carrying her 3-year-old daughter. Democrats and immigrant rights groups condemned the Trump administration's handling of the situation, accusing border agents of overkill. "These children are barefoot, in diapers, choking on tear gas," said California Governor-elect Gavin Newsom. "That's not my America." Trump doubled down, threatening to close the border with Mexico permanently and defending the use of tear gas, which was used about once a month by border agents during the Obama administration. "They were being rushed by some very tough people," Trump said. "Nobody is coming into our country unless they come in legally." The Trump administration is currently negotiating with incoming Mexican president-elect Andrés Manuel López Obrador to house migrants in Mexico while they await U.S. asylum hearings. This plan could end so-called catch-and-release policies that Trump says allow migrants to disappear into the country rather than show up for their hearings. What the editorial said. "The officers were right to repel the crowd," said the Wall Street Journal. "Our country can't tolerate migrants who rush the border or assault officers with rocks. The tragedy is that the migrants' lawlessness will erode support for legal asylum in the U.S. Germany should serve as a cautionary tale. Chancellor Angela Merkel welcomed 1 million Middle Eastern migrants to her country in 2015. But social problems caused by the massive influx sparked a political backlash that has abetted the far right and turned many Europeans against accepting any additional refugees. "Yes, we must defend our borders," said the New York Daily News, "but we must also defend America's principles. Under U.S. and international law, people who make a credible claim that they face persecution and violence at home can apply for asylum. if Trump weren't promoting fever dreams of an ongoing invasion to stir up his base, he wouldn't send troops to the border. He'd send hundreds of asylum officers and immigration judges to expedite claims. What the columnist said. The Trump administration is responsible for this mess, said Jennifer Rubin in the Washington Post. Last year, Trump listened to anti-immigration hardliners and rejected a bipartisan compromise that would have included $25 billion for increased border security in exchange for legal protection for Dreamers already in the U.S. Now, House Democrats should launch an investigation of this administration's failed, incoherent border policy. Who issued the family separation policy? Are there really Middle Eastern terrorists and stone-cold criminals in the caravan, as Trump contends? It's time to debunk Trump's racist, hysterical rhetoric. Actually, Trump was at least half right about the caravan, while the media was wrong, said Rich Lowry in NationalReview.com. Trump's critics scoffed at his description of the migrants as an invasion, but we've just seen hundreds try to scale fences. The overwhelming majority of these migrants are not criminals and just want a better life. But we have a right to demand an orderly, lawful process and to limit how many people we accept. The reality is that most of these migrants do not qualify for asylum under U.S. law, said John Daniel Davidson in TheFederalist.com. Of nearly 64,000 applications heard in court in 2016, less than 14% were approved. Most Central American migrants are not fleeing political oppression. For them, claiming asylum is simply a way to gain entry into the U.S., where they can live and work while their cases go on for years. In the short term, said Elvia Diaz in the Arizona Republic, the border chaos couldn't have played out better for Donald Trump. He got the images he wants of young men defying authorities and trying to climb over the border barriers. Now Trump gets to say, see, I told you so, and just in time for a border wall funding fight. By losing patience and trying to gain entry illegally, the migrants lost. Trump won, at least for now. And we'll go ahead and read the second main story this week, titled Trump Shrugs Off Grim Climate Report. What happened? President Trump this week dismissed a dire climate report issued by his own administration, one that paints a chilling picture of the economic and environmental damage unchecked climate change could inflict on the U.S. Compiled by 13 federal agencies over 2.5 years, the 1,656-page National Climate Assessment was released on Black Friday, several weeks ahead of schedule, in an apparent effort to minimize its impact. The report notes that the U.S. is already suffering the consequences of climate change, which has helped fuel devastating wildfires in California and powerful hurricanes in the South. Climate-related devastation, it says, will only increase in coming decades. Rising seas could displace millions on the East Coast. Yields of crops, including corn, wheat, and soybeans, could decline as temperatures rise, and the Southeast could end up with a fire season. By 2090, climate change could cut up to 10% from the country's gross domestic product, more than double the hit taken during the Great Recession. The severity of future impacts, the report said, will depend largely on actions taken to reduce greenhouse gas emissions and to adapt to the changes that will occur. The White House downplayed the report, saying in a statement that it was based on the most extreme scenario and promising a more data-driven assessment that would offer balance. President Trump was more blunt. I don't believe it, he said of the report, later adding that people like myself, with very high levels of intelligence, don't accept the scientific consensus that human activity is responsible for climate change. What the editorial said. This report is yet another reminder that reality will catch up to the U.S. no matter how much the president tries to ignore and deny it, said the Washington Post. With their agenda of rolling back tailpipe and smokestack emission standards and pulling the U.S. out of the Paris Climate Accord, Trump and the GOP are inflicting long-lasting damage, and the costs are becoming clearer by the day. Future Americans will not forgive or forget what these leaders did to them. Trump worries about the impact anti-warming measures might have on jobs and prosperity, said the Baltimore Sun. But a forward-looking climate change policy isn't a zero-sum game. Yes, jobs will be lost as we move away from burning fossil fuels, but as many, if not more, will be gained in energy conservation and renewable energy. The longer Americans wait to adopt some rational approach to lessening the climate threat, the greater the price tag. What the columnist said. It's time for a carbon tax, said Catherine Rempel in the Washington Post. Republicans love to cite the power of the private sector to innovate our way out of problems. Well, taxing carbon would give energy utilities, automakers, and tech startups an incentive to innovate faster and cut our reliance on polluting fossil fuels. And if Republicans truly want to walk the walk on cutting the excessive government regulations they claim to hate, they can start with the subsidies and regulations, such as tariffs on imported solar panels and tax breaks for oil companies that inhibit the growth of green technology. Take a breath, said Stephen Koonin in the Wall Street Journal. A careful reading reveals that the report's numbers, uncertain as they are, turn out to be not all that alarming. An increase in average global temperature of 9 degrees Fahrenheit, a worst-case scenario, would reduce GDP by about 4%, according to the report's calculations. Count that against the 2% per year that GDP can conservatively be expected to rise, and the effect is minimal. There are many reasons to worry about climate change, but national economic catastrophe isn't one of them. Conservatives need to pull their heads out of the sand, said S.E. Cupp in the New York Daily News. We can still be skeptical of the climate solutions offered by liberal absolutists. Everybody go vegan. But denial of climate change itself is no longer an option. When you attack science and dismiss warming while pointing to a mound of snow in your backyard, you are part of the problem. The sooner Republicans confront reality, the sooner they can get to crafting a conservative strategy to combat it. Our controversy of the week, Roberts, why he defended the judiciary against Trump. Under normal circumstances, Supreme Court justices strenuously avoid commenting on politics, said Dara Lind in Vox.com. But President Trump has finally annoyed Chief Justice John Roberts enough for Roberts to speak out. The Chief Justice issued a rare public rebuke of President Trump last week after Trump sneeringly referred to a federal judge who temporarily blocked the administration's new asylum policy as an Obama judge. We do not have Obama judges or Trump judges, Bush judges or Clinton judges, Roberts said. What we have is an extraordinary group of dedicated judges doing their level best to do equal rights to those appearing before them. This is hardly the first time Trump has attacked the legitimacy of courts that rule against him, said John Cassidy in NewYorker.com. So why did Roberts choose to speak up now? With the appointment of Justice Brett Kavanaugh, Trump has made it clear that he sees the court as his political ally, boasting about how the administration will win there now that it has a solid 5-4 conservative majority. Read between the lines of Roberts' statement, and he appears to be saying, "Not so fast, Mr. President. We are not your poodle. Trump is right, said Mark Thiessen in the Washington Post. Everyone, left and right, knows that presidents appoint judges who share their ideological leanings. That's why Republicans blocked Obama's appointment of Merrick Garland, and why Democrats tried to filibuster Trump's appointment of Neil Gorsuch. In 2016, exit polls showed that 70% of voters said Supreme Court appointments were an important factor in deciding their presidential vote. In complaining about judges, Trump finds himself in good company, said Daniel Flynn in the American Spectator. Presidents have lashed out against rulings they don't like, going back to Thomas Jefferson and Marbury versus Madison. President Obama infamously dressed down the Supreme Court justices present at his 2010 State of the Union address over their decision in the Citizens United campaign finance case. Trump's grousing is hardly atypical. Roberts' decision to criticize the president is. Roberts certainly knows that his own statement is a lie, said Peter Dreyer in the American Prospect. But Roberts is a much savvier politician than Trump. A lifelong conservative, Roberts has used his perch at the top of the nation's highest court to achieve Republican goals such as rolling back the Voting Rights Act, loosening rules on corporate spending and politics, and weakening the power of labor unions. Roberts knows that for such rulings to have lasting legitimacy, the court needs to preserve at least a veneer of independence. That means Trump better not count on Roberts' vote, said Noah Feldman in Bloomberg.com. In order to preserve the court's prestige and the rule of law, the Chief Justice might look for select areas to check the president's power when there's a credible legal argument for doing so, like refusing to shield the president from Special Counsel Robert Mueller or House Democrats. A major constitutional crisis may be coming, said Ross Douthat in the New York Times. The Supreme Court's legal supremacy over the White House depends on the presidency's willingness to accept the court's rulings. This president is probably too politically weak to win a stark power struggle with the Roberts Court. But sooner or later, a showdown between the increasingly powerful executive branch and the judiciary is coming. That's the important message of Trump v. Roberts. Let those with ears hear. It was a good week for British cats, with a warning from the UK's Royal Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals that vegan pet owners who put their cats on a meat-free diet are abusing them and may be breaking the law. Pet owners are legally required to take reasonable steps to ensure that the pet's needs are met, the group said, and cats are very strict carnivores. It was a good week for winging it after two boys, ages 14 and 15, stole a single-engine Cessna from a private Utah airport and flew about 15 miles before successfully landing the plane. And it was a good week for state TV after emails revealed that former EPA Chief Scott Pruitt dictated what questions he'd be asked before appearing on Fox News morning program Fox and Friends, and in some cases, was even asked to approve the script. But it was a bad week for speed, after a German teenager lost his driver's license only 49 minutes after receiving it. The unnamed 18-year-old was clocked at 60 miles per hour in a 30 miles per hour zone. Some things last forever, others not for an hour, said a philosophical German police spokesman. It was a bad week for a new nickname after President Trump tweeted, "So great that oil prices are falling," adding as a personal note, "Thank you, President T." So far, the nickname has not caught on. And it was a bad week for denial. After a British prison inmate claimed a cell phone that guards found secreted up his rectum wasn't his. Until guards found contact information for his friends and relatives on the phone SIM card. Dylan Martin's sentence was extended by 6 months. And before we leave this page, a short piece, Looking Under the Martian Sands. After a seven-month journey across 300 million miles, NASA's InSight this week became the eighth craft to successfully complete a Mars landing. The agency's lab in Pasadena, California, erupted in cheers upon receiving a grainy photograph from the red planet. Now that we're on the surface of Mars, we have a lot of work to go, said engineer Elizabeth Barrett, who leads the $850 million mission. The 800-pound lander will stay parked for 2 years, running on solar power and using its 6-foot-long robotic arm to handle scientific instruments. The goal is to study the deep interior of Mars, measuring Mars quakes with a probe 16 feet beneath the surface. After a series of successful missions, NASA says it hopes to send humans to the planet in the 2030s. Our briefing page article this week is titled, The Politics of Pre-Existing Conditions. Obamacare's most popular provision has become the new third rail of American politics. What are pre-existing conditions? A pre-existing condition is any health problem that exists before a person applies for new medical insurance. Serious chronic conditions like cancer, diabetes, heart disease, asthma, and HIV/AIDS are obviously on the list of illnesses health insurance companies want to avoid covering. But insurers have also defined nearly every medical and psychological problem, including acne, toenail fungus, anxiety, and depression, as a pre-existing condition. The Affordable Care Act, better known as Obamacare, bars insurers from denying coverage or charging higher premiums to individuals with pre-existing conditions. More than 25% of American adults under 65 years old, or about 52 million people, have a pre-existing condition that would have prevented them from buying individual health insurance before Obamacare was passed in 2010. Recent polling shows that 75% of Americans support keeping the new protections in place. Protecting people with pre-existing conditions is now like motherhood and apple pie, said Larry Levitt, a healthcare policy specialist at the Kaiser Family Foundation. How did the system work before Obamacare? Insurers routinely denied coverage to sick people who tried to get new coverage, perhaps because they'd lost their jobs or were self-employed. A 2010 study found that 36% of adults who had tried to buy an individual plan over the previous 3 years were rejected, charged a higher price, or had certain treatments excluded. One major insurer maintained a list of 425 medical diagnoses that it used to justify declining coverage. 35 states organized high-risk insurance pools to help cover people who were otherwise uninsurable. But many of these plans charged premiums of up to 200% of the average market rate, while also having higher deductibles and fewer benefits. The cost was catastrophic, said Craig Britton, who once paid $18,000 per year in Minnesota's high-risk pool because of his pancreatitis. You have to have a good living just to pay for insurance. What did Obamacare do? It made it possible for health insurance companies to insure everyone. The Affordable Care Act did this by providing insurers with enough healthy customers to subsidize the sick ones, although premiums did rise. Obamacare attracted millions of new customers by providing subsidies to low and middle income people and by requiring through an individual mandate that almost everyone in the country had to buy insurance or pay a tax penalty. It also provided risk adjustment payments to compensate insurance companies for taking on sicker, more expensive patients. Did this system work? Yes, but imperfectly. More than 20 million people have gained coverage since Obamacare was passed in 2010, including many with pre-existing conditions. But the trade-offs involved made the law politically toxic. Many Americans rejected the individual mandate as unwarranted government intrusion and paid a fine instead of complying. Adding to the law's unpopularity, premiums for individual plans spiked during the first few years of the program, after many of the new enrollees turned out to be sicker than expected. Republicans made repealing Obamacare a centerpiece of their political message, ultimately taking Congress and the White House. During the 2016 presidential campaign, candidate Donald Trump vowed to terminate Obamacare. Nevertheless, he also promised to keep protections for pre-existing conditions without explaining how it would be done. "It's a modern age," he said. "I think we have to have it." What have the Republicans actually done? The Trump administration and Republicans in Congress have succeeded in rolling back parts of Obamacare, with the 2017 tax cut bill eliminating the individual mandate. But GOP leaders have struggled to come up with a politically viable replacement for the system set up by the ACA. House Republicans narrowly passed a plan in 2017 that would have still required insurance companies to cover people with pre-existing conditions while allowing them to charge much higher premiums. The bill died in the Senate without a vote, with polls showing only 17% approval for the bill. The Senate also narrowly voted down a last-ditch skinny repeal bill that supposedly would have protected pre-existing conditions, even while killing off the law that guarantees they are covered. Are those protections now safe? Not really. The White House has issued new rules allowing consumers to buy cheaper, bare-bones plans that can deny coverage to sick patients, which undermines the ACA. 20 Republican-controlled states have also sued in federal court, arguing that all of Obamacare's requirements are unconstitutional without the individual mandate. The Trump administration has given its support to that lawsuit rather than defending the ACA. If the lawsuit succeeds, the ACA and the protection of pre-existing conditions is dead. In the midterm elections, Democrats campaigned heavily on protecting the ACA, with health care consistently ranking as the number one issue for voters. In response, many Republicans who adamantly opposed Obamacare were forced to promise they'd protect pre-existing conditions. Before the passage of the Affordable Care Act, Americans broadly embraced a national obligation to ensure the elderly, the poor, and the disabled, said Dr. David Blumenthal, president of the Commonwealth Fund. "We've now added the sick to this list. If the past is prelude, there will be no retreating from this commitment." Time for a few of the columns. We'll start with one from Tim Romer at usatoday.com. He says, "Betrayed Catholics must act. Catholic clergy can no longer be trusted to fix the church's sex abuse problem," said Tim Romer. "The laity must act. This much became clear after a Pennsylvania grand jury revealed hundreds of children to be victims of both sexual abuse and a cover-up by high-level priests, spurring investigations of the church in at least six other states. It became clearer still when Pope Francis recently ordered U.S. bishops to delay implementing any sex abuse reform proposals. These betrayals compel faithful Catholics to act to save our church. First, the laity should demand via petition that the church turn over all pertinent records to law enforcement and support, not oppose, revising statutes of limitations to enable prosecution of past abuser. Lay leaders should get involved in overseeing clergy assignments and develop better screening procedures for priests. We should consider allowing clergy to marry and women to be ordained as priests. Most importantly, Catholics should withhold donations until the clergy hear us and respond. Those of us in the pews need to stand up, make our voices heard, and demand results. The safety of our children and the fate of our church are at stake. This is from the Ukraine. Is Russia trying to take another chunk? Ukraine is under attack, said Boris Sokolov. Russian warships rammed and fired on three of our naval vessels this week as they attempted to sail from the Black Sea port of Odessa through the Kerch Strait, the narrow channel between the Russian-occupied Crimean Peninsula and the Russian mainland, to Mariupol on the Sea of Azov. Officers from the Russians' FSB intelligence agency boarded the vessels and took all 23 crew members captive, six of whom had been injured in the clash. Moscow then temporarily blocked the Kerch Strait by placing a tanker under a new bridge connecting Crimea and mainland Russia, effectively blockading Mariupol and other Ukrainian cities on the Azov coast. Russia claims its actions are justified because the three Ukrainian ships violated Russian waters, a pathetic lie, since a 2004 treaty grants both countries access to the strait and the sea. Moscow clearly wants to turn the Sea of Azov into a Russian lake, and it is spitting on international law to do so. In response, Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko has put the military on full combat alert and had the legislature declare martial law for 30 days. Some fear Poroshenko overreacted, said Valery Pekar, or even that he intends to use his emergency powers to delay the presidential election he is expected to lose next March. But that's unlikely. This is, in fact, an emergency. Russia's goal is nothing less than the destruction of Ukraine as an independent state. 4 years ago, Russia occupied Crimea and parts of our Donetsk and Luhansk regions using Russian soldiers disguised as volunteer militiamen. This new aggression, though, is breathtakingly blatant, with Russian guns blazing under the Russian flag right in the open. Maybe we should have seen it coming, said Natalia Balyuk. Moscow has been trying to cut off our vital trade port in Mariupol, which is surrounded by pro-Russian forces in Donetsk, for months. It has been stopping and searching ships, causing delays and throttling Mariupol's economy. Now Russian President Vladimir Putin has decided the time is right for a small victorious war that might distract Russians from their economic woes. What happens next depends on our allies. Ukraine needs military and financial assistance, and the international community must unite behind us in demanding new sanctions on Russia. Yes, the cohesion of the West has never been in greater doubt, said The Times in an editorial. While the U.S. did belatedly condemn Russia's aggression, President Donald Trump himself gave only an ambivalent statement saying, "We don't like what's happening, and hopefully we'll get it straightened out." That's not sufficient. It is vital that the West speak loudly and with one voice to insist that Russia give Ukrainian ships unhindered access to Ukrainian ports. Because if Putin is allowed to continue destabilizing Ukraine, we risk a wider conflict that could affect the whole continent. And we'll finish with a business column. This is David Lennard at the New York Times. Don't let monopoly kill democracy. The Boston Tea Party wasn't about taxes. It was about monopoly, said David Lennard. What riled up the colonists was that the Tea Act of 1773 let one politically connected seller, the East India Company, shut out all the local competition. A strong strain of anti-monopoly sentiment has run through our politics ever since. But over the past 15 years, big companies have become ever more dominant. Home Depot and Lowe's now control 80% of the home improvement sector. Just about all phones now run either Android or iOS. In industry after industry, the market share of the two largest companies has grown. The new corporate behemoths have been very good for their executives and largest shareholders, and bad for almost everyone else. We know how this ends: higher prices and lower wages. So what are we going to do about it? We need a new political movement that continues the legacy of the Boston Tea Partiers, Thomas Jefferson, Theodore Roosevelt, and the other defenders of the economic little guy. You can already see the beginnings of that movement, and it's nonpartisan. Bigness worries both parties, because with monopoly, the people don't rule. Big corporations do. Inevitably, the U.S. will have to break up today's giants, just as we did with AT&T and Standard Oil. Moving on to our in-depth article, titled this week, "Nothing on This Page Is Real." A liberal blogger feeds right-wing conspiracy theorists with blatant falsehoods, earning up to $15,000 a month, said journalist Eli Saslow. Across the country, the lost and lonely read the lies and pass them on. The only light in the house came from the glow of three computer monitors, and Christopher Blair, 46, sat down at a keyboard and started to type. His wife had left for work, and his children were on their way to school. But waiting online was his other community, an unreality where nothing was exactly as it seemed. He logged onto his website and began to invent the first news story of the day. "Breaking," he wrote, pecking out each letter with his index fingers as he considered the possibilities. Maybe he would announce that Hillary Clinton had died during a secret overseas mission to smuggle more refugees into America. Maybe he would award President Donald Trump the Nobel Peace Prize for his courage in denying climate change. Blair had launched his website on Facebook during the 2016 presidential campaign as a practical joke among friends, a political satire site started by Blair and a few other liberal bloggers who wanted to make fun of what they considered to be extremist ideas spreading throughout the far right. In the past 2 years on his page, America's Last Line of Defense, Blair has made up stories about California instituting Sharia, former President Bill Clinton becoming a serial killer, undocumented immigrants defacing Mount Rushmore, and former President Barack Obama dodging the Vietnam draft when he was 9. "Nothing on this page is real," read one of the 14 disclaimers on Blair's site. And yet, in the America of 2018, his stories had become real, amassing an audience of as many as 6 million visitors each month who thought his posts were factual. What Blair had first conceived of as an elaborate joke was beginning to reveal something darker. Blair's own reality was out beyond the shuttered curtains of his office, a three-bedroom home in the forest outside North Waterboro, Maine, where the paved road turned to gravel. Not his house, but a rental. Not on the lake, but near it. Over the past decade, his family had moved around the country a half dozen times as he looked for steady work, bouncing between construction and restaurant jobs while sometimes living on food stamps. During the economic crash of 2008, his wife had taken a job at Wendy's to help pay down their credit card debt. And Blair, a lifelong Democrat, had begun venting his political frustration online, arguing with strangers in an internet forum called Brawl Hall. He had created more than a dozen online profiles over the last years, sometimes disguising himself in accompanying photographs as a Southern blonde woman or as a bandana-wearing conservative named Flag Eagleton, baiting people into making racist or sexist comments and then publicly eviscerating them for it. Now he hunched over a desk wedged between an overturned treadmill and two turtle tanks, scanning through conservative forums on Facebook for something that might inspire his next post. He was 6'6" and 325 pounds, and he typed several thousand words each day in all capital letters. He noticed a photo online of Trump standing at attention for the national anthem during a White House ceremony. Behind the president were several dozen dignitaries, including a white woman standing next to a black woman, and Blair copied the picture, circled the two women in red, and wrote the first thing that came into his mind. President Trump extended an olive branch and invited Michelle Obama and Chelsea Clinton, Blair wrote. They thanked him by giving him the finger during the national anthem. Lock them up for treason. Blair finished typing and looked again at the picture. The white woman was not, in fact, Chelsea Clinton, but former White House strategist Hope Hicks. The black woman was not Michelle Obama, but former Trump aide Omarosa Newman. Neither Obama nor Clinton had been invited to the ceremony. Nobody had flipped off the president. The entire premise was utterly ridiculous, which was exactly Blair's point. We live in an idiocracy, read a small note on Blair's desk, and he was taking full advantage. In a good month, the advertising revenue from his website earned him as much as $15,000, and it had also won him a loyal army of online fans. Hundreds of liberals now visited America's last line of defense to humiliate conservatives who shared Blair's fake stories as fact. How could any thinking person believe this nonsense, he said. He hit publish and watched as his lie began to spread. It was barely dawn in Pahrump, Nevada, when Shirley Chapin, 76, logged on to Facebook for her morning computer game of Criminal Case. She believed in starting each day with a problem-solving challenge, a quick mental exercise to keep her brain sharp more than a decade into retirement. She spent an hour as a 1930s detective, interrogating witnesses and trying to parse their lies from the truth, until finally she solved case number 48 and clicked over to her Facebook news feed. Click like if you believe we must stop Sharia law from coming to America before it's too late, read the first item, and she clicked like. Share to help end the ongoing migrant invasion, read another, and she clicked share. The house was empty and quiet except for the clicking of her computer mouse. She lived alone, and on many days her only personal interaction occurred here, on Facebook. Mixed into her morning news feed were photos and updates from some of her 300 friends. But most items came directly from political groups Chapin had chose to follow. Free Speech Patriots, Taking Back America, Ban Islam, Trump 2020, and Rebel Life. Outside Chapin's window was a dead-end road of identical beige and brown rock gardens surrounding double-wide trailers that looked similar to her own, many of them occupied by neighbors whom she'd never met. She'd spent almost a decade in Pahrump without really knowing why. She had no family in Nevada. She loved going to movies, and the town of 30,000 didn't have a theater. It seemed to her like a place in the business of luring people into the air-conditioned casinos downtown, into the legal brothels on the edge of the desert, into the new development of cheap housing available for no money down, and in some ways, she'd become stuck, too. Chapin had lived much of her life in cities throughout Europe and across the United States, places such as San Francisco, New York, and Miami. She'd gone to college for a few years and become an insurance adjuster, working as one of the few women in the field in the 1980s and 90s, and joining the National Organization for Women to advocate for an equal wage before eventually moving to Rhode Island to work for a hospice and care for her aging parents. After her mother died, Chapin decided to retire and move to Las Vegas to live with a friend. And when Las Vegas became too expensive, a real estate agent told her about Pahrump. She bought a three-bedroom trailer for less than $100,000 and painted it purple. A few years after arriving, she bought a new computer monitor and signed up for Facebook in 2009, choosing as her profile image a photo of her cat. "Looking to connect with friends and other like-minded people," she wrote then. For years, she had watched network TV news, but increasingly, Chapin wondered about the widening gap between what she read online and what she heard on the networks. One far-right Facebook group eventually led her to the next with targeted advertising, and soon Chapin was following more than 2,500 conservative pages, an ideological echo chamber that often trafficked in skepticism. Climate change was a hoax. The mainstream media was censored or scripted. Political Washington was under control of a deep state. It had been months since she'd gone to a movie. It had been almost a year since she'd made the hour-long trip to Las Vegas. Her number of likes and shares on Facebook increased each year until she was sometimes awakening to check her news feed in the middle of the night, liking and commenting on dozens of posts each day. Now another post arrived in her news feed from a page called America's Last Line of Defense, which Chapin had been following for more than a year. It showed a picture of Trump standing at a White House ceremony. Circled in the background were two women, one white and one black. President Trump extended an olive branch and invited Michelle Obama and Chelsea Clinton, the post read. They thanked him by giving him the finger during the national anthem. Chapin looked at the photo, and nothing about it surprised her. Of course Trump had invited Clinton and Obama to the White House in a generous act of patriotism. Of course the Democrats, or demon rats as Chapin sometimes calls them, had acted badly and disrespected America. "Well, they never did have any class," she wrote. By the standards of America's Last Line of Defense, the item about Michelle Obama and Chelsea Clinton was only a moderate success. It included no advertisements, so it wouldn't earn Blair any money. It wasn't even the most popular of the 11 items he published that day. But just an hour earlier, Blair had come up with an idea at his computer in Maine, and now hundreds or maybe thousands of people across the country believed Obama and Clinton had flipped off the president. "Gross. Those women have no respect for themselves," wrote a woman in Fort Washakie, Wyoming. "They deserve to be publicly shunned," said a man in Gainesville, Florida. "Not surprising behavior from such ill-bred trash. Jail them now." Blair had fooled them. Now came his favorite part, the gotcha. "Okay, taters, here's your reality check," he wrote on America's Last Line of Defense, placing his comment prominently alongside the original post. "That is Omarosa and Hope Hicks, not Michelle Obama and Chelsea Clinton. They wouldn't be caught dead posing for the pseudo-patriotic nationalistic garbage. Congratulations, stupid." Blair didn't have time to confront each of the several hundred thousand conservatives who'd followed his Facebook page. So he'd built a community of more than 100 liberals to police the page with him. Together, they patrolled the comments, venting their own political anger, shaming conservatives who had been fooled, taunting them, baiting them into making racist comments that could then be reported to Facebook. Blair said he and his followers had gotten hundreds of people banned from Facebook and several others fired or demoted in their jobs for offensive behavior online. What Blair wasn't sure he had ever done was change a single person's mind. The people he fooled often came back to the page, and he continued to feed them the kind of viral content that boosted his readership and his bank account. Invented stories about Colin Kaepernick, kneeling NFL players, imams, Black Lives Matter protesters, immigrants, George Soros, the Clinton Foundation, Michelle and Malia Obama. Well, they never did have any class, commented Shirley Chapin from Pahrump, Nevada, and Blair watched his liberal mob respond. That's kind of an ironic comment coming from pure trailer trash, don't you think? You're a gullible moron who just fell for a fake story on a liberal satire page. Welcome to the internet. Critical thinking required. Chapin saw the comments after her post and wondered, as she often did when she was attacked, who were these people and what were they talking about? Of course Michelle Obama and Chelsea Clinton had flipped off the president. It was true to what she knew of their character. That was what mattered. A Muslim woman with her burqa on fire. A policeman using a baton to beat a masked Antifa protester. Like. Hillary Clinton looking gaunt and pale. Like. A military helicopter armed with machine guns and headed toward the caravan of immigrants. Like. Instead of responding directly to strangers on America's last line of defense, Chapin wrote on her own Facebook page. Nasty liberals, she said, and then she went back to her news feed, each day blending into the next. This was excerpted from an article that originally appeared in the Washington Post. And we've got time for one of the articles on the Talking Points page. Ocasio-Cortez, already the center of attention. Conservatives have found their latest liberal boogeyman, said Leah Fessler in QZ.com. And it's freshman Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez of the Bronx, New York. At 28, the former bartender won a primary upset over a 10-term male incumbent that catapulted her into the national spotlight, and her democratic socialist agenda, social media savvy, and natural chutzpah are electrifying progressive millennials. Naturally, the right already has an obsession with Ocasio-Cortez and is seizing on every opportunity, however ridiculous, to mock and diminish her. When Ocasio-Cortez had her Capitol Hill orientation a few weeks ago, critics jeered at her claim that she has just $7,000 in savings and can't afford D.C. rent, with one conservative troll sneering that since she was wearing a decent black suit, she doesn't look like a girl who struggles. But such derision only deepens her connection with young people and working-class Americans of color who see her as their representative on the national stage. If that sounds familiar, said Emily Jahinsky in TheFederalist.com, it's because smug nitpicking from partisans is exactly what solidified support for another unpolished populist, President Trump. It's true that Ocasio-Cortez, who supports free college, free medical care, and federal jobs guarantee, often sounds like the freshman who comes home from one semester of college ready to overthrow capitalism. But constantly ridiculing the youngest woman ever elected to Congress sounds petty and elitist. Personal attacks on her are unfair and counterproductive, said Chris Deaton in WeeklyStandard.com. Instead, conservatives should focus on her ideas. Instituting Medicare for All, as she suggests, would be the largest transfer of costs onto the government in American history, with taxpayers on the hook for more than $3 trillion a year. That's what matters, not the $3,500 suit she borrowed for a photo shoot. The fiery newcomer doesn't make just Republicans nervous, said Elaine Godfrey in TheAtlantic.com. Shortly after arriving in Washington, Ocasio-Cortez joined 200 youth protesters outside Nancy Pelosi's office and urged Congress to establish a climate change committee tasked with crafting a Green New Deal. Party elders are probably thrilled that a young woman of color is arousing so much excitement, but some Democrats fear her zealousness is a liability that risks fracturing fragile party unity. They wish she would rein it in a little, but she probably won't. And a couple of short notes. The global suicide rate has dropped 29% since 2000, apparently because of improvements in the quality of life. The U.S. suicide rate has risen 18% since 2000, mostly because of the decline in quality of life for white, middle-aged men without college degrees. Only 60% of students who began college in 2010 graduated within 6 years. There are 46.5 million people in the U.S. who started college but never finished. And we'll finish up with a quote from journalist Paul Howard, who says, "The social contract between humans and dogs might be the best bit of business we have ever done." And with that, we've run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you've enjoyed it. Please be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The broadcast is available as a podcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. If you have any questions or comments, please give us a call, 919-832-5138.